Today's Monday, July 5th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Junior Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Philippine military probes an air crash that killed 47 people.
All 96 passengers of the deadly Philippine Air Force plane crash have been accounted for, the military said on Monday.
Plus, dozens missing after a landslide in Japan.
Rescuers in Japan on Monday searched for 80 people still missing, 2 days after landslides tore through the Japanese seaside city of Matami.
Also, Pope Francis spends first night in a room hospital after intestinal surgery. Our top story today is in the Philippines. The Philippine military has launched an investigation into a plane crash that killed at least 47 people. A spokesman said on Monday, the Lockheed C-130 transport aircraft was in, quote, very good condition, unquote, prior to the crash. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
All 96 passengers of the deadly Philippine Air Force plane crash have been accounted for, the military said on Monday. Officials say 47 people were killed in the Sunday incident, while the rest sustained injuries. A number of soldiers jumped out of the aircraft before it hit the ground, sparing them from the explosion caused by the crash. That's according to a joint task force statement. 3 civilians were also killed on the ground and 4 injured. As recovery efforts continued, trucks were seen hauling away body bags. The plane overshot the runway after it touched down at Jolo Airport in southern Sulu province. A military spokesman said the challenge now is identifying the charred bodies at the crash of the site. He added that the Lockheed C-130 aircraft was in, quote, very good condition, although the military has grounded one other aircraft of the same model. A probe has been ordered into the crash, which will begin after the recovery efforts.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. Government airstrikes and artillery fire in Syria's last rebel enclave killed at least 8 people, many of them children, and destroyed a civil defense center and a water station. AP correspondent Karin Chamas reports.
Men running for their lives as shelling strikes an area in southern Idlib. One white helmet first responder, also known as the Syria Civil Defense, tells everyone to get out of their homes and flee as the shelling continues. The shelling has been concentrated in southern Idlib province. Many homes were transformed into rubble as overnight shelling hit the home of Supi El Asi, a health center administrator, killing him, his wife, and 3 of his children in their sleep. Shelling also struck the home of a volunteer for the White Helmets, killing his 2 children. In a nearby village, another child was killed and several others from the same family were wounded, according to the White Helmets. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the shelling was followed by airstrikes by suspected Russian warplanes that hit areas west of Idlib city. I'm Karen Chamas.
Tariq Bitter, the judicial investigator probing last year's devastating explosion at Beirut's port, is seeking to file negligence charges against several Lebanese lawmakers and top security officials. He asked Parliament to lift the immunity of 3 members, former Finance Minister Ali Hassan Khalil, ex-Public Works Minister Ghazi Zeitar, and Nuhad Masnoug, a former Interior Minister. The 3 men, he said, had been officially notified while in office that a vast cargo of ammonium nitrate had been unloaded at the port in 2014, and failed to take measures to reduce the risk of an explosion. Joe Macaron, a fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, discussed Lebanese developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi.
The investigation has taken a long time. There were several top investigators that were changed. The process was not transparent. So what might come next? I think it was on the level of the ministers. But I think there's a higher executive leadership of the country that also bear responsibility of knowing what happened, especially in the last few months before the explosion. So I think we should wait and see how this investigation will move now to the next phase, dealing with public suspects, which are named. But knowing how the Lebanese system functions, knowing the state of the country at this stage, there's some skepticism, I think, while watching the process moving forward.
The U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the U.S.'s expectation is that Lebanon's leaders show sufficient flexibility to form a government that is willing and capable of urgently implementing the necessary reforms to rescue the country's deteriorating economy. Is that feasible?
In principle, it's also feasible, but obviously there are many complicated aspects of the Lebanese collapse. First, there is the domestic rivalry, which is continuing now, especially between the president and the designated prime minister. Second, there's the aspect of unclear status of the U.S.-Iranian talks, and until we have clarity on this, also we might not see an urgency, especially by Iran to form the government. And also there's reluctance from the political class to form the government because they would have to face a growing list of demands and reforms, and they have to face this reality of collapse. Now there's no basically public accountability. There's no government in place to basically put all the blame on. There's a big power vacuum, and whoever gonna lead this government has collectively and individually to deal with this reality of collapse and enforce reforms that will not be popular, and also deal with the international community, whether with the IMF and the World Bank or other organizations. So I think we don't see the urgency, neither in Lebanon or abroad, to form the government.
Political instability in Lebanon is coupled with a deteriorating economy and living conditions amid soaring food prices, fuel and medicine shortages, and the Lebanese currency having lost 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar since 2019. What's the way out?
A couple of decades ago, whenever there's a crisis, the Lebanese relied on Gulf aid. Now this is not available. So the only way out is either to increase revenue, which is not foreseeable at this point, given how the country is not feasible now for investment, or to cut significantly the expenses, which also the political class is not willing to do, because this is how it serves their interests, basically to expand the bureaucracy, to employ their supporters. So it requires a very difficult decision. I think just negotiating with the IMF and getting more money to basically fund the same inefficient bureaucracy, it won't be a way out. There should be a clear shift of attitude, clear shift of mentality in how Lebanon sees the public sector. There's a cut in the electricity reforms and in the security sector, and the size of the bureaucracy in general. It's difficult to see a way out at this stage without a clear shift in the political class or in its attitude toward the state, but without a clear political process, a clear pressure from the international community and from the Lebanese to push the political class either out of the game or to advance a genuine process of political and economic reform.
That's Joe Makaran, a fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shanawi. Taliban insurgents have continued to make rapid territorial gains in Afghanistan. This as the United States says its last remaining troops are expected to withdraw from the conflict-torn country by the end of August. On Friday, the U.S. said it had turned over the Bagram airfield, a central hub of activities where operations against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were directed for nearly two decades. Reporter Ayaz Gol explains the situation on the ground to International Edition's Steve Miller.
Well, what we have seen over the last few days, over the last month or so, that it's the Taliban that have been conducting major attacks, and have so far within the past 2 months have brought like one-third of Afghanistan's 420 districts under their control, which is very significant. That is the only news which is coming out of Afghanistan. The Taliban have captured 5 districts, 4 districts, 10 districts, and even yesterday they captured 15 districts. We don't have the Afghan government anywhere. President Ashraf Ghani has not been, appearing in public, making no statements. So that's a worrying sign that Taliban are making these rapid territorial gains. And the Afghan security forces, who were trained by the United States and NATO allies for years, spending billions, tens of billions of dollars on this training project, are just crumbling. And in most cases, they are not putting up any resistance and simply retreating or surrendering their weapons to Taliban insurgents as soon as they attack a district.
On Friday, it was announced that the United States had turned over Bagram Airfield. What kind of impact is that having on not only Afghan troops, but the morale of people throughout Afghanistan who really saw that base as a central piece to the operations, not only against Al-Qaeda, but the Taliban from the U.S. and NATO forces?
Well, frankly speaking, the moment that announcement was made that the American and coalition forces have vacated the Bagram Air Base, I think that has had a very serious impact on the hopes, on the morale and, energies of Afghans, because I have spoken to people in Kabul and they are worried. There is total chaos over the last 2-3 days. People are really unclear and uncertain about whether they will be able to fight it off, the Taliban's offensive. Now that this Bagram Air Base has been vacated, that has been the key to, containing Taliban advances in Afghanistan over many, many years. And now that that facility has been vacated, there is serious doubts and reservations about the capabilities of the Afghan forces to really utilize this base for any productive counteroffensive. So that really has fueled concerns and added to the uncertainty that has been prevailing for the past many, many months. But over the last 3-4 days, speaking to people on the ground, there is total chaos and they don't know what will be the end of this confusion, whether Taliban will take over Kabul very soon, because we have had reports that last night Taliban fighters tried to stage an assault on the Bagram Air Base. But then we heard from Afghan officials that they were able to defeat that attack and they were in full control of the Bagram Air Base. So that really has added to the problems facing the Afghan government and Afghan security forces and the nation in general, who don't know whether they're going to be ruled by the current government or the Taliban will soon regain control of power in Afghanistan.
That's Ayaz Goh speaking to my colleague Steve Miller from Islamabad, Pakistan. More than 1,000 Japanese rescuers combed through crumbled houses and buried roads on Monday, 2 days after landslides tore through a seaside city. The rescuers are fighting time and poor weather to search for about 80 people believed missing. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Rescuers in Japan on Monday searched for 80 people still missing, 2 days after landslides tore through the Japanese seaside city of Atami. Video footage captured by rescue teams showed an injured woman being carried to safety. One 75-year-old evacuee said the house across from his had been swept away, and the couple that lived there was missing. "This is hell," he said. Landslides over the weekend were triggered by torrential downpours, with some areas seeing more rain in one day than the whole of July. Around 130 buildings were affected by the disaster, and the official death toll stands at 3, according to Mayor Sake Sato. He added the number of missing had come down from over 100 earlier Monday morning. City officials have warned residents to remain vigilant, noting threats from soft ground and ongoing weather. The landslides are a reminder of the natural disasters that haunt Japan, where the capital of Tokyo is to host the Summer Olympics beginning this month.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Pope Francis has spent the first night after intestinal surgery in a Rome hospital. The Vatican has said he responded well to the surgery Sunday evening to remove part of the Pope's colon. Francis was convalescent on Monday in a special suite reserved for the pontiff at the Gamaliel Polyclinic, a Catholic hospital. The 84-year-old Francis had developed an intestinal stenosis, or narrowing. Israel's parliament is set to vote on whether to renew a temporary law first enacted in 2003 that bars Arab citizens of Israel from extending citizenship or even residency permits to spouses from the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Critics say it's a racist measure aimed at preventing the growth of Israel's Arab minority, while supporters say it's needed for security purposes and to preserve Israel's Jewish character. Israel's dominant right-wing parties strongly support the law, but the new government includes left-wing opponents of the measure. Cybersecurity teams are working feverishly to stem the impact of the single biggest global ransomware attack on record. Some details are emerging about how a Russian-linked gang responsible breached a company whose automated network management software was the conduit. Thousands of victims have been identified in at least 17 countries, with ransom demand of up to $5 million reported. The FBI says the scale of the attack means it may not be able to respond to each victim individually. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. North Korea's coronavirus lockdown has taken a major toll on its economy. Its leader, Kim Jong-un, has hinted at a humanitarian crisis. Some fear the situation could get worse, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
North Korea may be the only nation to claim it is COVID-19 free. But even it now admits a worsening pandemic-related crisis. Last week, Kim Jong-un vaguely warned of a mysterious grave incident suggesting a major coronavirus lapse. He also recently acknowledged food shortages, comparing the situation to a devastating 1990s famine. Robert Lawler is with the Daily NK, a Seoul-based news outlet with sources in North Korea.
There's worries that there'll be another arduous march type of situation.
The arduous march refers to the period of mass starvation during the rule of Kim's father, the late Kim Jong-il, which may have killed millions. It's impossible to say how bad the situation is now. There are no signs of mass starvation. But Lawler says the prices of food and certain luxury items from China have skyrocketed amid North Korea's toughest-in-the-world lockdown.
People are hurting because of the closure of the border, because of the poor harvest last year, because your movements are restricted. People, particularly in the border region with China, aren't able to conduct their business activities, official or unofficial.
Despite the crisis, North Korea isn't showing urgency on coronavirus vaccines. VOA has learned Pyongyang hasn't even completed all the paperwork to get vaccines from COVAX, a UN-backed vaccine-sharing initiative aimed at assisting low- and middle-income countries. It's not clear North Korea has vaccines from anywhere else either, puzzling observers like Yang Mu-jin. Yang says he doesn't know why North Korea has refused vaccines, adding North Korea isn't known to have any particular aversion to them, like some do in the West. North Korea's basic predicament is that it wants to keep the border closed to protect from the virus, but must open it in order to get vaccines. It's a situation that may not threaten Kim's rule, but will get riskier the longer it lasts. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
The World Food Program says it has delivered a first batch of food for thousands of school children in Venezuela. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The delivery follows a deal concluded earlier this year between the UN Food Agency and the government of Venezuela. Schools in Venezuela currently are closed, so World Food Program spokesman Thompson Fieri says his agency will provide take-home rations, which families will pick up at the schools where the children are enrolled.
Our plan is to reach gradually 185,000 people, including children under the age of 6 and school staff, by the end of the year. The ration that I've spoken about is enough to cover a child for 30 days, which is a month.
The WFP says 42,000 food packages have arrived at its logistics hub in Maracaibo, Venezuela's second largest city. Each package contains more than 11 kilograms of food, including rice, lentils, iodized salt, and vegetable oil. Venezuela's once prosperous economy has been in free fall since President Nicolas Maduro came to power more than 8 years ago. The United Nations says more than 5.3 million people have fled the country because of political repression and harsh economic conditions. Official figures about the health status of Venezuelans are not available. A WFP study in 2020 suggests, however, one in three Venezuelans do not have enough nutritious food to eat daily. A study by the Swiss charity Caritas of five Venezuelan states and the capital Caracas found 16% of children under 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. The condition can cause stunting, wasting, cognitive difficulties, and even death. The WFP says its work in Venezuela will focus on the provision of nutritious school meals, the rehabilitation of school canteens, and the training of school staff to observe and implement the highest food safety practices. The agency says it hopes to expand its school feeding program to include 1.5 million children and school personnel by the end of the 2022-2023 academic year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Researchers in New Zealand have developed a new technology that could make bridges more resilient to earthquakes. Their so-called, quote, low-damage solution, unquote, has a series of rocking bridge columns that move with seismic shocks, leaving bridges with little to no damage compared with conventional building methods. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
More than 900 bridges were damaged during the Kaikoura earthquake on New Zealand's South Island in 2016. Roads and railway lines were also destroyed, disrupting the transport network. Researchers at the University of Canterbury have said that although current designs prevent the collapse of bridges, significant repairs might be needed. They've developed flexible columns made of high-strength steel that move during an earthquake. They act like giant rubber bands to bring bridge supports back into position. Conventional steel bars are also used to dissipate seismic energy, reducing the impact of a powerful tremor. Alessandro Palermo is a professor in structural engineering and materials at the University of Canterbury. He says the technology makes bridges more resilient.
This special steel, which is usually placed in the middle of the column, is actually working as a rubber band. So during the earthquake, this high-strength steel is actually trying to bring the pier back to the original position. And we're actually trying to combine these resilient solutions, seismic resilient solutions, with accelerated bridge construction. How can we actually build bridges faster and at the same time resilient? This system allows to do that.
In February 2011, the New Zealand city of Christchurch was hit by a magnitude 6.3 earthquake. 185 people were killed and several thousand injured. A decade later, rebuilding work continues. Each year, more than 15,000 earthquakes are detected in New Zealand. Only about 150 are large enough to be felt, but building homes, offices and bridges that can withstand major tremors is a priority. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A car with wings recently completed a test flight in Slovakia. Its designer said a successful journey brings us one step closer to flying cars, but experts aren't so sure that's happening anytime soon. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has more.
You may one day soon look up to see a car overhead if the designers of the Air Car Prototype 1 have anything to say about it. Here's the inventor speaking with Markiza TV.
It's great that the legislation allowed something like this to go from a virtual location to the real one. This is our goal, to create a product that you will be able to buy one day.
From the drawing board to the friendly skies, air car inventor Stefan Klein piloted his craft for 35 minutes from Nitra to the Slovakian capital, Bratislava.
We arrived at the airport in the dark. Then we pulled the machine to the runway. Even though I have flown it for many hours, when you go on a long trip, it's a different feeling.
The 160-horsepower air car designed with retractable wings completed more than 40 hours of test flights and reached a maximum cruising speed through the air of 190 kilometers per hour. Still, the Slovak Transport Research Institute's Lubomir Palchak tells Markiza TV this project is in its infancy.
We cannot say that in the coming years we'll be used flying cars here, but it's very good that this topic arises in Slovakia, and there's a concrete result.
The test flight cut travel time in half from one city to the other and marked the 142nd successful landing. Klein Vision says its next step is to build a 300-horsepower prototype 2 with a 300-kilometer-per-hour cruising speed and 1,000-kilometer range. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Makhbir Yabaro, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.